Lots of people enjoy heading for the ocean for an outing. There's something timeless about watching the waves crash on the beach. But it's what's in those waves that certainly changes over time. Today's guest has a long history with and love for the ocean, and he details that relationship in a memoir called Saved by the Sea: Hope, Heartbreak, and Wonder in the Blue World. David Helvarg is the author. He's one of those guys that's hard to profile in a few sentences. He's a journalist, private investigator, documentary producer, and scuba diver, among other talents and pursuits. He's the executive director of Blue Frontier, an ocean conservation group. He has written other books about the ocean, The Golden Shore, and Rescue Warriors. This book, again, is a memoir. David Helvarg, thanks so much for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thanks, Jeffrey. Glad to be here.
So when and where did you fall in love with the ocean?
Oh, like a lot of people as a kid. I mean, you know, you can go back, well, you can go way back to, like a lot of kids, your mom takes you to the beach and, you know, you're 4 or 5, you get knocked over by a wave and you kind of come up sputtering and look out at that vast ocean and realize you're part of something bigger than yourself. I grew up on Long Island on the North Shore. We had a dock where we used to play with these ancient horseshoe crabs, and I remember once, my sort of boy gang would like to skip them across the water, and then there were the older kids who called the hoods who'd put them in rock corrals and smash their shells. And once, by kind of just dint of number, we chased the hoods away, and this old eel fisherman came over, told us, you know, you got to defend the critters that can't defend themselves. And that kind of, I guess, was my first sense of what social justice was. But when I was about 15, my mom took my sister and me down to the Florida Keys, Key West, and I remember until then I'd sort of been a little PO'd that I thought I was a generation too soon to explore alien worlds and go off into space. And I remember just getting a mask and snorkel and going off the seawall, and there was like this living rock, you know, colorful rocks and a little hammerhead swimming through shoaling fish. I saw my first sea turtle and realized, you know, there's this whole alien world right off our shores that we can access fairly easily, even in the cold waters of Northern California and Southern Oregon.
It is weird to think about all the abundant life there that is basically out of sight unless you get right up to the water's edge, and even then you're seeing just a fraction of it.
Yeah, and the scary part is sort of in the blink of an eye in which I've lived my life. I mean, when I was down there when I was 15, it was 90% live coral cover in the Florida Keys, and today it's 5 to 10%. It's just the huge impacts from pollution runoff and physical impacts and climate change and chemical changes in the water. So we're sort of discovering this wonder even as we're putting it at risk.
What was that number again on coral cover? That was staggering.
Yes, it went from 90% to less than 10%. And in the Florida Keys, staghorn and elkhorn corals are now on the endangered species list. And, you know, I've been on the Great Barrier Reef, and a lot of the people who run the marine sanctuary in the Florida Keys, they sort of speak wistfully of better management in Australia. But the reality is not that it's much better managed. It's just 10 times as large with one-tenth the number of visitors. At some level, we're loving the reefs to death, but a lot of it's also just ignorance. The things we don't know tends to put our living oceans at risk. And I mean, just one example, just this month, just last week, Wednesday, April 1st, there was a Pemex oil rig that blew up in the Gulf of Mexico, killed 4 workers, 3 are still missing, almost 50 injured, and luckily not a massive oil spill like had happened on a Pemex rig in 79 and happened 5 years ago with the BP spill that also killed 11 workers. On the next day, Thursday, a giant 330-foot Russian factory trawler sank in the Pacific, killing 56 crew members, including Russians and Burmese. And then the next day, 300 mostly Burmese slaves were rescued by the Indonesian authorities. They were being held on Thai pirate fishing boats and on an isolated island in Indonesia. And these are kind of, you know, the overfishing, the pollution, the loss of habitat, and fossil fuel-fired climate change are just altering the ocean at a tremendous clip. And these are sort of the challenges that we have as advocates for healthy oceans, is if you know, it's either we win and begin to restore the marine wildlife and the health of the ocean, as can happen, as has happened to a large degree in California, or we just see this ongoing kind of cascading disaster with, you know, pirate fishing being essentially a form of organized crime that involves, you know, human trafficking and slavery as well as illegal take. And as I say, it links up, you know, when you fish out the grazers on a coral reef, the parrotfish, for example, algae grows, the reef begins to die. You know, when you take out the big fin fish, you end up fishing down the trophic levels. I mean, today one of California's major fisheries is sea urchin. And, you know, it's like, you know, when you've taken out the really big fin fish, then you end up with the bottom feeders and grazers and herbivores like that.
Well, you're talking about the sea urchin being a big fishery now. Abalone was once a big fishery, and you detail in the book what happened there. Is that non-existent now as a fishery?
As a commercial fishery, yeah, and maybe with protections. Paul Dayton, who's one of the top kelp forest scientists in the world down at Scripps, I've been to talks he's given to scuba divers, says with the limitations or restrictions, maybe we'll see restoration in 50 years, but some of these things are slow, and in 50 years, the ocean water is going to be a lot more acidic, which is going to make it tough for any shellfish or shell-forming critter, be it an abalone, a clam, or a coral. So, you know, we used to say, you know, think globally, act locally. Now it's kind of like we got to think and act locally, regionally, nationally, and globally simultaneously, because the challenges are multifaceted. But the solutions are promising, and Northern California, Southern Oregon are, you know, a place I look for solutions.
All right, we'll talk about what some of those solutions are, and we'll even define the problems a little more as we go through this conversation with David Helvarg. He's the author of Saved by the Sea, Hope, Heartbreak, and Wonder in the Blue World, a big lover of the oceans, but also quite knowledgeable about them as well, as you can tell. We'll come back and talk more with David and take your phone calls and emails when we return to the Jefferson Exchange. Please remember, it's our fund drive. Call in your pledge of support at 888-552-6191 or ijpr.org. And thanks for supporting Jefferson Public Radio. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is David Helvarg, longtime journalist, author, scuba diver, documentary producer, you name it. He has probably done it. He's also written three books about the sea, including his new memoir, Saved by the Sea, Hope, Heartbreak, and Wonder in the Blue World. You can join our discussion about the oceans and the challenges they face and the solutions to those challenges. Our phone number here on the exchange, 800-838-3760, 800-838-3760, or send emails to jx@jeffnet.org. You were talking earlier about growing up on Long Island. I did, too. I'm from Levittown originally, so I went to Jones Beach probably as much as you did.
Yeah.
And I remember the horseshoe crabs, too, taking them home. And, of course, they'd stink after a couple of days if they still had a lot of crab in them. But you were talking about the kids who smashed the horseshoe crabs with rocks, and I just wonder if that is the way we as a society have tended to view some sea creatures as disposable.
Well, yeah. I mean, for most of our history, we view the sea as a kind of endless cornucopia that we could take out of, and at the same time as a garbage dump we could throw all our waste into. And this is an ancient history. I mean, you know, here off the San Francisco Bay Area, you have the Farallones National Marine Sanctuary that the Navy and Atomic Energy Commission thought was a great place to dump all our nuclear waste right through the 1970s. So it's hard, you know. I mean, it's you go to the beach, and on the surface, it always looks the same, kind of the everlasting sea. And you know, it's hard to understand with its vastness that it's still susceptible to our impacts, that some scientists start talking about we're in the Anthropocene, the period of human impacts at a global level. But they're certainly there. And you know, the challenge is how we reverse them. I think we can. I think a good example is California, you know, the world's seventh largest economy with 38 million people, and we've turned things around significantly. We're sort of a late maritime frontier, but came to realize that there were solutions. And when you do some basic, make some basic choices like the Marine Mammal Protection Act, like banning gill nets off Southern California, or creating the State White Shark Protection Act, You see tremendous resiliency in the ocean, particularly in where we live with the California current that's been called the, you know, Serengeti of the Sea coming down from the Arctic, and it's at the same time one of the world's four great upwelling zones off our deep continental shelf. I mean, you know, a lot of people, come to the area and think that California and Southern Oregon is all sort of an extension of Malibu Barbie's beach house. But you know, you get around Point Conception and you're in some of the roughest ocean on the world, the North Pacific. You know, it's beautiful but deadly and challenging. And the harbor master in Crescent City told me that when you get north of Cape Mendocino, it's not really even Northern California; it's Baja, Oregon. wild waters that have restored. I mean, you know, when we did these right things at one point, after we chased the gray whales into Scammon's lagoons and slaughtered the mothers and calves there for oil in the 19th century, went after the northern elephant seals for their oil, and by 1896 there was an estimated 20 to 100 left on an island off Baja on Guadalupe Island, and Smithsonian sent an expedition. They spotted 10 of them, and they shot 7 for specimens to take back to the museum. Well, since the 1960s, because we left the habitat, the offshore islands, for feeding and breeding, and because we made some right decisions, they came back. There's one beach I visited near Hearst Castle in Central California that the first elephant seal hauled up there in 1990. The first breeding pair were spotted in 92. This year, over 21,000 returned to that one beach to breed and feed. You know, decisions in places like Port Orford, Oregon.
With the sustainable seafood?
And the ocean resource team with local fishermen who decided they weren't going to wait for the state and the feds to take the right actions. And some 15 years ago, they began to work on protecting their watershed, educating their kids, mapping their offshore waters, getting extra value for sustainable fishing product, but also designating part of their fishing grounds as a no-take area for restoring the resource. In fact, Lisa Cobb, who's one of the folks at the resource team there, is going to be part of our Blue Vision Summit next month in Washington, D.C. You have folks like the Coast Watch up in Oregon. You've got what I call seaweed, you know, marine grassroots activists all up and down the coast. And what's frustrating is, you know, not the problems. They're not, you know, I don't despair over these massive problems because I know what the solutions are. You know, you stop killing fish, they tend to grow back. If you don't produce 100 million tons of disposable plastic every year, it won't end up in the ocean. But the challenge is finding the political will to scale up the solutions as fast as the problems. We're not quite there yet, but we try and mobilize folks and see what we can do.
David Helvarg is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. He's the executive director of Blue Frontier, an ocean conservation group. He is also the author of the book Saved by the Sea, Hope, Heartbreak, and Wonder in the Blue World. Here's Bill and Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Hi, thanks for taking me. I have a couple questions that the common average person can do to help the fish and the planet and all that. And basically, I was wondering, could you tell me what species of fish which would help stop the drag netting, where they're dragging nets on the bottom and they bring everything up, and other types of fish that we should not buy because it's really killing all the other fish when they're trying to get those, and also disturbing the coral reefs and whole bottom when they're dragging these huge nets across the bottom. And also my second question is there a website people can go to see what type of fish they should not buy, like they shouldn't buy sardines or tuna or whatever, just so it would have a list of worst ones to buy and which ones are acceptable to buy to help get the fisheries back in shape and hopefully get the ocean acidity back to shape or whatever it takes.
Okay, thanks for that, Bill. Appreciate it. So, Bob, part two, I think, is the Monterey Bay Aquarium puts out a list of sustainable seafood, doesn't it?
They do. There are a number of places. Monterey Bay Aquarium is particularly well known for having a downloadable list of sustainable seafood, sort of green, yellow, and red. I mean, as a general rule, you eat lower on the food chain. Sardines make good Mediterranean food. You eat stuff that's abundant, you know, maybe calamari instead of shrimp, which, you know, I've been out on a shrimp boat where it's 8 pounds of bycatch for every pound of shrimp. They're good guides. General rule is, you know, don't eat the top predators. If you eat shark and big bluefin tuna and the like, they're not only essential for healthy oceans. Top predators, sharks, are like the wolves of the reef. They also of the kelp forest. And another top predator we have here is actually the sea otter, which keeps the kelp forest healthy. People luckily aren't eating them, but they're still eating shark. They're still eating these top predators that are not only essential to the ocean, but this is where all our toxins bioaccumulate up the food web. So, you know, if you're eating shellfish and smaller fish, you're probably doing better. Along with these guides, I talk about not only eating sustainable seafood, but eating more organic and local foods is also helpful to the ocean, because then you don't have all the synthetic fertilizers running down, following gravity into the ocean, creating these second crops of algae that create dead zones. I talk a lot about that in another book I did called 50 Ways to Save the Ocean, which is illustrated by my friend Jim Toomey, who does Sherman's Lagoon. It's kind of, you know, at least 50 things that all of us can do every day, you know, and I wrote that after my first ocean book, Blue Frontier. People would come up to me after I'd talk to them. They'd say, well, you know, I've got a job, or I'm looking for a job, or, you know, I've got a double course load at school, so what can I do about big issues like the collapse of marine wildlife or climate change? And the answer really is everything we do every day affects the seas around us. It's becoming conscious of what we're doing and making good choices. And the funny thing is the choices we make in terms of our energy use, our food, our transportation, turn out not only to be good for the ocean, they're good for us in terms of our pocketbook, our health, just our sense of well-being in being able to help turn the tide.
David Helfarch is our guest again on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is Saved by the Sea. He is also the head of the Blue Frontier and Ocean Conservation Group. Join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about ocean problems and solutions, both vast on an oceanic scale. Join us at 800-838-3760 out and about the listening area, 800-838-3760. The email address is jx@jeffnet.org. You were talking earlier about the things we don't know. We have a lot of things we don't know about the ocean. And in fact, I don't know whether to chuckle or grimace when you compare our exploration of Mars to our exploration of the ocean, but we really don't know a lot about what goes on down there, do we?
No, I mean, we've only effectively mapped about 5 to 10% of the ocean, where we've mapped, you know, 100% of the moon and Mars. And as I've said, you know, when we send NASA's budget, as much as it's shrunk, is still 1,000 times the size of NOAA's budget for exploration, the National Oceanographic. Jim Cameron in 2012 went, you know, followed two earlier explorers, Don Walsh, who lives in Oregon, and Picard, went down to the deepest part of the ocean in 1960, and nobody got there again till Jim Cameron went in 2012. So it's kind of odd. Over 500 people have traveled into space. You know, only 3 humans have been to the low point on our own planet. And when we go into space, we put a rover on Mars. What's the first thing we look for is water, as a sign of life. Here we have this whole swimming pool of a planet. 97% of the living habitat is within the ocean, and yet it's not very well explored. And we're discovering in the Monterey Canyon off California, they're discovering a new species almost every week. And some pretty impressive species like walking sharks and vampire squids. And, you know, you have places like Humboldt State that are on the cutting edge of discovery, because it's still a wilderness off our coast, particularly in Northern California. So there's, you know, the good news is it's not every nation that gets a second frontier. And the question is, are we going to make the same mistakes, or are we going to learn from the past and work to with some sense of awe and respect on what we don't know. I mean, just one example is we used to think if you just catch the big fish, the little fish will grow back and you don't have a problem. And this was actually fisheries policy for a long time. We didn't realize that a lot of fish have different, and a lot of sea creatures, different reproductive strategies. So like with grouper, all the small fish are female, and when they grow large, they convert to male. And if you take out all the big fish, then you got a lot of sort of single bachelorette groupers looking for a mate. And evolution's not sexist, so it works the other way, like with anemone fish, with Nemo fish. If you take out, if a barracuda eats the big female, the alpha female, then the next largest male will convert within a few days to a female. But I guess Disney wasn't ready to show Nemo's dad becoming his new mom.
Wow, I can imagine that. What was that figure you gave just a moment ago about 97% of the habitat in the ocean?
Yeah, I mean, 71% of the surface of our planet is salt water. But when you consider where we live, us land animals, I mean, basically you got sort of mole burrows 3 feet down and birds nesting in the tallest redwoods maybe 300 feet up. We've got like 300 feet of living space in the ocean. You know, from where shark fins are breaking the surface and turtles are munching on jellies and now too often plastic bags, the ocean goes down to 7 miles depth. The average ocean's around 12,000 feet. So this is all habitat for life, and much of life is, you know, photoluminescent life in the mid-water column that we've almost know nothing about. I can name two scientists who've dedicated their lives to studying that greater part of our living biomass on the planet. When I've been down, I spent a few months in Antarctica, and the krill are, you know, the most abundant marine life there. It's a very short food web there. The krill sort of feed everything, the penguins and the whales, and then there's, you know, just the orcas and the leopard seals that feed on the penguins. But I remember at Palmer Station one day on a Wednesday, the krill kind of, the bay sort of turned red with krill, and the next day there were four species of whale feeding in our bay, humpbacks and rights and sais, and it's a phenomena, you know, what you find when you just step off our coast.
It was like a krill bloom, it sounds like?
Yeah, krill movement. They mm-hmm. sort of migrate around, and of course the scientists down there are worried because they grow up under the bottom of the sea ice that expands each season, and they find it's like an upside-down coral reef where they grow up in the crevices. And when you lose sea ice, then, as some seasons are, especially along the Antarctic Peninsula where I was, as the sea ice declines, you see a decline in the krill. More south, more sort of open ocean jellies replace them, and with the warming we saw, you know, direct replacement. The Adelie colonies were collapsing, and chinstraps or more weedy birds, they were coming in. This scientist down there, Bill Frazier, said that when he grew up and went to graduate school, his professor had said, climate change is real, but you'll never see it in your lifetime. And he says just within the years he studied in Antarctica, he's seen whole ecosystems altered and species changing place and glaciers retreating. And so there's, you know, we're in this sort of moment of rapid, you know, change. Like I say, in the blink of an eye, I've lived my life. 90% of the large pelagic open ocean fish, the biggest billfish and sharks and groupers have disappeared. They didn't disappear. They went onto our plates.
I was amazed at that figure, though. 90% of the pelagic fish.
And it's, you know, we've taken so many of the big ones that scientists are now saying we're seeing a genetic shift where we're, even with protection, we probably won't see the record-breaking black marlin again because we took so many of the big fish that the genetic pool has now favored slightly smaller fish. The biggest breeding stock are just out of the system. And it's a tremendous challenge. That's next month, May 11 to 14, we're having our fifth Blue Vision Summit, bring about 500 ocean leaders, local leaders from around the country to D.C. and try and work with our policymakers and go up, have a Healthy Ocean Hill Day and, you know, meet with some of our friends and advocates. The congressman from Northern California is a good advocate for the ocean, as is Senator Schatz from Hawaii and White House from Rhode Island and Markey from Massachusetts, who we'll meet with. We have a Peter Benchley Ocean Awards. We're going to give one to Secretary of State John Kerry, who's actually, since he was a senator in Massachusetts, has been a strong advocate for the ocean, and as Secretary of State has worked to stop pirate fishing, to get expanded treaties, has also worked with the president to protect 500,000 square miles of the Western Pacific as national monuments, where essentially they become sort of wilderness parks, great national parks in the sea where you can't extract anything, and it creates a reserve of diversity for a rougher future we're facing.
David, when we talk about solutions, it seems like we've figured out pretty well what not to do, what to stop doing. I mean, do we still know anything or much of anything about what we can do to the oceans, things we can put in the oceans that make them better?
Well, a lot, yeah, we can put a lot more reserves in the ocean. I mean, the Port Orford folks established a protected area, and, you know, when you protect certain parts of the ocean, you restore these wilderness zones. 16% of California now has a network of these marine protected areas, and you have what they call the overflow. You know, the fish get bigger. I have a friend, Dirk, who drops ROVs, robot submarines, into these protected areas, and, you know, he sees tremendous comeback of wildlife, and that's good for all of us. And there's stuff we can do to clean up our ports and lots of other things I can talk about.
All right, a lot of ocean left to talk about with David Helvarg. His latest book is Saved by the Sea. We'll come back and talk more with him in just a few moments, and you can join us on The Exchange. We also remind you as we head to the break, it is day two of Spring Fund Drive. We welcome your pledges of support to keep programs like this on the air. Call in a pledge at 888-552-6191 or pledge online at ijpr.org. Thanks for listening. Thanks for donating. And we'll come back with David Helvarg on The Exchange in a minute 10. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is David Helvarg, longtime lover of the ocean, longtime journalist, private investigator, documentary producer, scuba diver. We could go on and on. He's also the executive director of Blue Frontier, an ocean conservation group. He's written books called Blue Frontier, The War Against the Greens, 50 Ways to Save the Ocean, Rescue Warriors, and The Golden Shore. And his latest book is called Saved by the Sea, Hope, Heartbreak, and Wonder in the Blue World. We are indeed talking about oceans, the many problems they face, the many solutions being offered up now. Join us on The Exchange at 800-838-3760 anywhere in our listening area, or send emails to jx@jeffnet.org. Nicole in Ashland, welcome to The Exchange with David Helvarg.
Hello. I just wanted to say that I wanted to really compliment your guest about his, not only his knowledge of the sea, his extensive knowledge, but his love. So many people have the knowledge but not as much love, and others have love and little knowledge. So he has both, and it's just wonderful, and I'm going to read his books. I haven't. And also, Jeffrey, I would like to thank you for being such a wonderful host, commentator, I suppose you are, dealing with everybody and asking very penetrating questions most of the time. You're just really excellent at what you do.
Thank
and,
you. You're very kind.
I just appreciate that. Thank you.
All right. Take care, Nicole. Appreciate it. So David, at some point you could have been an oceanographer. What got you off that track?
Oh, yeah. As a kid, I thought I'd be a, you know, frogman or an oceanographer. And but just I think it was the 1960s distracted me. I became an activist and then a journalist, a war reporter, and so I've spent the next 30 years in the schizophrenic state where I was going off to cover wars and epidemics so I could go home to body surf. But once I wrote my first book, Blue Frontier, it was one of those turning points in life. I just lost somebody I loved and didn't know what I was going to do next. I was thinking of going back to war reporting because I knew that was an antidote to depression, and this was right when Bush was ginning up to invade Iraq, and got a call out of the blue from Ralph Nader, who'd read my first ocean book in the last chapter called The Seaweed Rebellion, and asked if anybody was organizing these kind of hundreds of groups. I mean, there's more than 30 groups in Oregon alone that work on ocean protection and have solutions. And I thought about it. I figured we're always going to have wars. We may not always have, you know, healthy kelp forest or estuaries or coral reefs. And so anyway, I chose to fight for my surviving love, and plus I'd inherited the cat. I didn't know what to do with the cat if I went off to war. So I guess
this way you get to be with the cat and everything. Okay.
Yeah.
Nancy Ledansky did join you on your scuba diving expeditions. I mean, she really was a partner for a lot of your ocean explorations, it sounds like.
Yeah, Nancy, my late love, was definitely my adventure partner on a lot of this, and if not provocateur, I remember. you know, when we were down in Cabo at one point, and I got to ride on a whale shark, and she was kind of disappointed. She saw this giant shark heading towards us, and then I was riding it, and then she was upset that she was like, well, I said, it's a vegetarian. He says, lucky he didn't mistake you for a veggie burger. I think she was upset she didn't get to pet the shark and later over mojitos. I think I was telling her, you just have to watch more reruns of Jacques Cousteau specials. And she said, yes, absolutely.
Cousteau was a big inspiration for you, wasn't he?
I think so. I mean, I'm actually at the age where even before Jacques Cousteau, there was Sea Hunt.
Oh, right, with Lloyd Bridges.
Lloyd Bridges playing underwater investigator Mike Nelson. And it's funny, there's this whole generation of marine scientists and explorers who grew up on Sea Hunt. And now, of course, it's thrilling to work with Jean-Michel Cousteau, Cousteau's son. And at our summit in D.C., we're going to have Fabien Cousteau, who's like third-generation ocean explorer and conservationist. So there is, you know, that sense of continuity that, but yes, I mean, Cousteau brought the ocean, the silent world, into our living rooms back when there were only three channels, and now it's lucky he's got a son and grandchildren and nephews, because they sort of spread across the media spectrum and try and still get that message out that, you know, that we can turn the tide, and we can restore the blue in our red, white, and blue, all that good stuff. And as I say, on our website, which for Blue Frontiers, bluefront.org, we have a Blue Movement directory, and it's got some 1,500 groups across the U.S. who are doing good work. Two of our, with our Peter Benchley Ocean Awards, we're giving awards this year to the directors of the two Carolina groups in North Carolina and South Carolina, coastal groups that have protected over 1 million acres of coastline, are now fighting a really terrible and stupid idea to open up the Atlantic and the Arctic to new oil drilling. There are all these, like I say, seaweed activists who are doing effective work. And I think the Peter Benchley Awards that I helped found with Wendy Benchley are kind of really become the Academy Awards of the Ocean. We're also giving one to Prince Albert of Monaco this year. We've given it to heads of state from Africa and Latin America and Oceania who've done really large-scale effective work. And we call it the Peter Benchley Awards because everybody knew Peter wrote Jaws and thought that he was bad for sharks, but most people don't realize he spent most of his life working to protect sharks and their habitat. And so, you know, we name the award so we can educate people around Peter as well.
That's good to know that you can clear up his reputation along the way. Let's take a call from another Peter in Ashland. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with David Helvarg. We're talking about oceans and their preservation.
Hi. Funny, while I'm waiting here is to have Jacques Cousteau come up. As a teenager, I worked in the Boston State House, and he spoke to the whole, the whole group, and it was one of the more powerful experiences I've had in my life, I'd have to say. But earlier, your guest had mentioned the idea of how do we bring these things home to everyday life, and I really wanted to put in a plug for this place, washedashore.org, and they're up in Bandon, I believe it is.
Oh, right, yeah, we've talked to them in the past.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah, and just amazing. It really brings home more than anything how much plastic we buy. And it really, it changed when we went up there with the kids in their school. It really changed our household anyway, as far as just realizing.
It's presented in an artistic way. I mean, they do make artwork with the stuff, as I recall, but they're making artwork with stuff they pull off the beaches, and it's just some ungodly gross things.
Right. It's beautiful. I mean, the artwork's beautiful, but the scary thing is it's all based on 1 mile of beach that they're collecting it on. And you think, how much plastic is getting into our waterways, and in some ways it's like, it's a petrochemical product. It's like an oil spill that doesn't go away. But we appreciate these artists who sort of make it real for people that the vast amounts, and it, you know, it continues. It's not just the large marine debris, the lost fishing nets that continue to ghost fish, but the, all this plastic breaks down into fine dust that's fully integrated into the food web, and unfortunately, these polymers also act as kind of sponges absorbing all the chlorinated toxins like PCBs and DDT about a million times as effectively as seawater. So it concentrates the pollutants, and it gets so small it gets eaten by small fish that get eaten by big fish that get, you know, end up on our plates. So it's this cycle of toxins we need to break. I mean, I, you know, get my eggs in cardboard cases, but I also work to pass laws banning microplastics and plastic bags, and you know, we have to, like I say, work at many levels. Somebody said, do you think it's personal change or political? And that's kind of like saying, do you quit smoking or oppose the tobacco companies? You know, we got to reduce our plastic use, and we have to make sure that we create incentives to get off plastics and oil and move on.
I wonder, David, about recovery. I mean, we talk about restoration and doing good things for the ocean and setting up areas for protection. But you know, one of the fisheries you mentioned in the book is the cod fishery in the North Atlantic that was so critical for so many years that just collapsed. And are there any signs of that fishery coming back?
Very slight, but they're actually seeing some cod in New England. This is after 30 years, but you also see displacement where in the Maritimes in Canada, there's a lobster fishery growing, and it's not just warmer water. It's that the big cod that used to eat the little lobster are gone, and so you see this sort of trophic shift in species. As he said, we used to have, you know, vast amounts of abalone off the West Coast, and it may be 50 years before we see real restoration. The ocean's changing, and part of the change is that when we get rid of certain things, other things come and fill their ecological niche. The hopeful part is that we have seen some comeback in you know, areas like some of the big predators and some of the great whales, and there's hope, and we, you know, a healthy blue economy depends on how much we protect. Scientists say we should protect 20% of the ocean as reserves, and right now in the last 10 years we've gone from 1 to 3%. So that's a start, but we gotta accelerate it. When you do the right thing, I mean, another great example: the port of LA in Long Beach was so polluted 10 years ago that the surrounding neighborhoods of San Pedro and Wilmington and Long Beach had higher rates of adult cancer and childhood asthma, and they were all these lawsuits, there was no growth in the ports. They finally brought in a reformer who moved a clean air action plan between the two ports, and in the last 8 years, they've reduced air pollution 75%. The lawsuits went away. New port terminals are expanding. And so here you see an example of, you know, by cleaning up the environment, they expanded the economy. $1 billion of goods crosses those docks every day. The water's clean enough that juvenile white sharks now hang out at Queen's Gates, one of the two main entries to the largest port complex in the Western Hemisphere. So it's not only in rural areas like Jefferson that you can see restoration, but also along our urban coasts. As I say, we know what to do. Sometimes we have to retreat from the sea and let erosion take its path. Other times we simply, as has been done in Northern California, we, you know, the fishing fleet was overcapitalized, and they decided to invest in buying down the fleet. So there are fewer boats, but they're making better livings, taking fish more selectively.
So we certainly have reason to hope, but we have a lot of work to do as well, so they go hand in hand. David Helvarg, again, is the head of the Blue Frontier organization, and you can find that at bluefront.org. He's the author of the recent memoir, Saved by the Sea. David, thanks so much for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here, and like I say at the end of my book, you know, it's just, we don't know if we can turn the tide. All we know is if we don't try, we lose, and our blue marble planet's just too precious and awe-inspiring to risk that.
All right. Thanks again. Take care. We'll talk to you down the road.